So lovely to sit with you all. And today, I thought we'd continue on this somewhat meandering journey of the Four Noble Truths, which we started in January. And Four Noble Truths being, there is suffering in this human realm, and suffering, the Pali word is dukkha, which can be translated as stress, dissatisfaction, or the image of the wonky wheel on a cart, on the ox cart back in the day, and for us more like at the grocery store. But there are causes for this suffering, the various ways in which we grasp and cling and hold on or push away the aversion. But there's a way to end this, to understand, to have insight into the nature in which we cling and cause our own suffering, add that second, third, fourth arrow to our own suffering, so to speak. And the fourth noble truth is this path, this eightfold path, the eight branches of a tree, or whatever image may come to mind, that it's not linear, one, two, three, four. It's just this, Ajahn Sumedha talks about, is this the eight-legged animal upon which we can rest and supports us. And these eight pieces really support our lives. The first two, we spoke about this last time, of the different baskets, the first two being wise understanding, wise view, to kind of orient the mind to a way of thinking about how do we show up in this human realm to find some ways of freedom from the suffering that's just inherent to this human condition. The second basket, as it were, is our actions, how we speak, wise speech, wise action, literally, how do we move, what do we do in the world, and livelihood, what work, the ways in which we sustain ourselves, our family, is the work that we're doing in alignment with our values. This third basket of wise mindfulness, concentration, wise effort is more the heart basket of how do we really orient from a heartful place and how we move. Last week, we explored together the teachings briefly on wise effort. And today is the branch perhaps of mindfulness. And mindfulness in the last, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, it's now everywhere. I checked yesterday that on Amazon, there are 60,000 books with a title of mindfulness. And it's in so many different aspects of our lives. The debate between secular mindfulness and mindfulness of has a more religious connotation. There's mindfulness in the schools, mindfulness in sport. George Mumford's an amazing book on mindfulness, and his support with working with athletes in the NBA. Tim Ryan, a congressman out of Ohio, bringing mindfulness to politics. Rhonda McGee here at the University of San Francisco is doing a lot of work and bringing mindfulness to help the disease, shall we say, of racial bias in the justice system, and her work with lawyers and with police officers. I want to share a little bit from an article that she wrote about mindfulness. A decade of research indicates that mindfulness and compassion practices assist in raising awareness of our emotions and sensations in a given moment, regulating emotional responses and significantly reducing anxiety, increasing empathy, perspective taking, increasing overall gratitude and well-being. This all suggests that mindfulness and compassion practices may be important to creating the general conditions that support minimizing of bias. Mindfulness practice help give us focus, give us greater control over our emotions, increase our capacity to think clearly and act with purpose. Might mindfulness assist police and other public servants in minimizing the mistaken judgments that lead to such harms? Might they help the rest of us, professors and deliverymen alike, minimize our biases? In a word, yes. The good news is that mindfulness and related practices do assist in increasing focus and raising awareness, and have been shown to minimize bias. While research is ongoing, studies are beginning to show that mindfulness, meditation, and compassion practices serve as a potent aids to the work of decreasing bias. May it be so. Right. So it's out in the world, and it's here within us. And how do we work with this practice? And the invitation in the morning sit, or the anchor to work with our thoughts, this can be such a place to really be able to pay attention. With our, the line of with our thoughts, we create our world. Okay, what is the world we are creating? And what we think from about to watch your thoughts. They become your words. Watch your words. They become your actions. Action becomes habit. Habits become character. Character becomes destiny. So this idea of working with our beliefs, working with our thoughts. Borrow from Byron Katie. Right. Is it true? This thought that I'm having, is it true? Is it real? Tara Brock's line, true. It's real, but true. We can feel our feelings or our thoughts can feel real, but are they actually true? How do we decolonize, decondition the mind to be able to have a sense of being able to see clearly? And this is the invitation of the Vipassana practice. It's insight practice. It's based on clarity of seeing more clearly what's happening, of stepping out from under the hindrances, liberating the heart. And the hindrances, the five hindrances being the clinging, aversion, restlessness or anxiety, sloth or torpor in the mind or in the body, and doubt. And that this collection of hindrances can really block us from being able to see clearly, to understand, again, the conditioned mind, the habit mind, and be able to see, oh, is this pattern of thinking, the story I tell myself, is it true? Can I see more clearly all that goes into the way the mind works to be able to step out again from under the conditioning to say, okay, wait, where is a sense of freedom and clarity that can come from the mind? Sharon Salzberg, in an article in Tricycle Mindfulness, Tricycle Magazine. She writes that her favorite definition of mindfulness came from the New York Times article in 2007, about an article talking about the mindfulness in schools in Oakland. They asked a fifth grader what mindfulness is, and he said, it means not hitting someone in the mouth. That is a great definition, she writes, of mindfulness, because it implies, first of all, being in touch with oneself, knowing you're starting to feel angry when that feeling is just beginning, rather than after you've hit someone in the mouth or, say, after you've sent that email or text. It implies, and this is crucial, a balanced relationship to that anger. Life can be frustrating. And if you get subsumed or overwhelmed or defined by anger, then you're likely to hit a lot of people in the mouth. On the other hand, if you hate what you're feeling or are ashamed of what you're feeling or try to push it away, then you're going to get tighter and tighter and tighter until you explode. And I would add sometimes that if you hate what you're thinking, the way that sometimes we're like, ah, I can't believe I thought that, or that we can feel ashamed of having a thought, that mindfulness, she continues, mindfulness is the middle place where we're neither consumed nor we reject what's going on. We're neither consumed nor do we reject what we're thinking or what we're feeling. We have the ability to be present such that we're interested in what's going on. We have the ability to be fully present such that we're interested in what's going on, but we're not forming judgments or dashing off into the proliferation of the mind. Being with what is, we can create a space where creativity arises and other options arise. With mindfulness, she says, is a way we can inhabit our lives. We can be present to our experience. So the way that mindfulness gives us a chance to notice, like, oh, there's the thought. Okay. When we actually look at what a thought is, not much there. We can add to it. Emotions, and when we get so caught up in frustration or rage, we can add fuel to it. And just to be clear, that the invitation for a steadiness of the mind is not synonymous with becoming a doormat of like, okay, the world is the way it is, I can't do anything about it, and not acting in any way. It's just being able to act from a responsive, wise, and compassionate place, rather than from a heated reactionary place. This can feel powerful when we're up here in the agitated place, but it's not sustainable. When we can move from a place of centeredness and groundedness and responsiveness, when we can mine the anger for the wisdom that's there, then there's a skillful response that can come. Joseph Goldstein, in another article from the Tricycle, he talks about a Labrador Retriever consciousness. You may be familiar with labs. They're playful, friendly dogs who seem to be very much in the moment, lost in the world of sight and sound and smell. It doesn't seem like they're ruminating about the past or future, but at the same time, they're not. They don't seem to be mindful at all. They just run around from what, like, oh, bone, dog, you know, bone, ball, smell. They run around like that. And he's like, our own minds are very similar. Even if we're not lost in thought, we may not be mindfully arriving, observing what is arising. He makes a distinction between attention and mindfulness. We can pay attention to something, but the added layer with mindfulness is we're aware that we're paying attention. So we're not like the Labrador running all around paying attention to the ball, to the bone, but we have an awareness of, oh, this is what the mind is doing. Mindfulness has an ethical component, he writes, which is knowing our experience without the often unnoticed filters of greed and aversion. So being able to step out from, or perhaps a better way to say that, being able to see how the fetters of greed, hatred, and delusion cloud the clarity of our thinking, most certainly influence our actions, as we can see in our own lives. And we can certainly see how that plays out. These forces of greed, hatred, and delusion are playing out locally, nationally, globally, and the profound impact that when individuals are caught by those conditions of the mind, so much harm can come. Ajahn Sumedho has a book called Mindfulness, The Path to the Deathless, and it's an online book only. And he talks about the gifts of when we are awake to our own, what's happening, in the sense of being able to be with what is, understanding, oh, the world is like this. This body is like this. Okay. And from that place, we can make choices. Again, it's not to tip into indifference or whatever. It's just like this, I can't do anything but more. Oh, isn't this interesting? He writes, for life for one who isn't awake or isn't aware can become depressing or bewildering, especially when disappointments and tragedies occur. One becomes overwhelmed because one does not observe things as they are. He writes, Dhamma, which actually means the way it is, it's the natural law. When we observe and practice the sense of being with what is, we open our minds to the way things are. In this way, we're no longer blindly reacting to each sensory experience, but we understand, oh, this is a craving, this is a desire, I don't have to act from it. When we also can observe the unsatisfactory of our sensory experience, we know that whatever happens, there can be a moment they're like, this is great, and then it passes, that there is such a impermanence to where we can rest, again, in that sensory experience of the whatever we think we want, we get it, and it's like, okay, that didn't work, or that isn't lasting. Whatever we're pushing away, there is not a satisfaction in the pushing away. So much of human misery, he writes, comes out of expecting a lot and never quite being able to get everything one has hoped for. In our meditation, an insightful understanding of the way things are, we can see beauty, refinement, pleasure are impermanent conditions, as are pain, misery, and ugliness. If you really understand this, then you can enjoy and endure whatever happens to you. Much of the lesson in life is learning to endure what we don't like in ourselves and what we don't like in the world around us. Being able to be patient and kindly and not make a scene over imperfections in the sensory experience, we can adapt and endure and accept the changing characteristics of the sensory experience. Our being human, we have a mind that can reflect and observe. And in this reflection and observation, there's space. We can create a clearing in the dense forest of our minds, to borrow from a line from the poet Martha Postlewaite. The way of the Dhamma is one observing nature and harmonizing our lives with the natural forces. All that arises, pass away. All that is born will die. all that comes together will separate. When we can relax into this impermanence as a truth, there's freedom there. When we can see that the thoughts arise and pass away, that they are not solid, there can be a freedom of, oh, this is just a thought. The doubt that can come in about our lives, the thoughts that we can have about others, it's a story we tell ourselves. We are told stories about ourselves growing up. The story of the math teacher who said you sucked at math or you can't do art, or the father that said you were stupid, or the mother that didn't have a story because she didn't pay attention. Okay, those are the things we inherit. And through this practice of being able to notice and listen to what we tell ourselves, we can start to make choices. Does this fit the story that I grew up hearing about myself? Can I put it, if it's not serving me, can I change the story that society might tell about us? The story that we might have heard from teachers or from people in the workplace. Is it true? Is it really true? How do you know it's true? Again, pulling in Byron Katie. How do we look at and free ourselves from stories, narratives, beliefs that we have that are not actually in alignment with what we truly value? So part one of that is really being able to reflect what does matter, what is important to me, and how we show up in the teachings. Here are the 10 perfections of the heart, the paramis of integrity and wisdom and wise effort and truthfulness and patience and equanimity and resolve and loving kindness and generosity. I think those are the 10. That those might be the anchors of what we value. There's a question in here to consider of, what do I actually value? But before we get to the exercise, I want to read a couple poems. This from Robert Bly, Things to Think. Think in ways you've never thought before. If the phone rings, think of it as carrying a message larger than anything you've ever heard, vaster than 100 lines of Yeats. Think that someone may bring a bear to your door, maybe wounded and deranged, or think that a moose has risen out of the lake and he's carrying on his antlers a child of your own whom you've never seen. When someone knocks on the door, think that he's about to give you something large, tell you you're forgiven, or that it's not necessary to work all the time, or that it's been decided that if you lie down, no one will die. From Naomi Shihab Nye, the words under the words. My grandmother's hands recognize grapes, the damp shine of a goat's new skin. When I was sick, they followed me. I woke from the long fever to find them covering my head like cool prayers. My grandmother's days are made of bread around pat-pat in the slow baking. She waits by the oven watching a strange car circle the streets. Maybe it holds her son. Lost to America. More often tourists who kneel and weep at mysterious shrines. She knows how often mail arrives, how rarely there is a letter. When one comes, she announces it a miracle, listening to it read again and again in the dim evening light. My grandmother's voice says nothing can surprise her. Take her shotgun wound and crippled baby. She knows the spaces we travel through, the messages we cannot send, our voices short, and would get lost on the journey. Farewell to the husband's coat, the one she loved and nourished, who fly from her like seeds into a deep sky. They will plant themselves. We will all die. My grandmother's eyes say Allah is everywhere, even in death. When she talks of the orchard and the new olive press, when she tells the stories of Jonah and his foolish wisdoms, he is her first thought. What she really thinks of is his name. Answer if you hear the words under the words. Otherwise, it's just a world with a lot of rough edges, difficult to get through, and our pockets full of stones. So I ask you to close your eyes. And just to check in, where are you? How's the body? Locating yourself in your own body. I want to touch back to that first earlier question of what do you really value? What's important to you? What matters in this lifetime on this day? If you were to pick a heart quality or one or two or three, humor, generosity, joy, truthfulness, patience, whatever words come as you perhaps let that question echo. What do I value? Love, family, friendship. What's most important to me? Again, seeing what arises, what might pop up like wildflowers in the mind. What matters? What do you love? And again, just kind of letting whatever comes, come. Watching what may pop up, whether it's in images or words. Perhaps pick one or two or three of those qualities that most deeply resonate with what matters, what you hold dear, how you want to show up in this life for yourself, for others, for the community, for our fellow humans on this planet. And perhaps those words form a constellation that can serve as a guide in the night sky, this constellation of your values, of what's important, or signposts on this path that you are on. And perhaps guided by these values of what's true and important to you in heart. I'm going to ask each of you if you're willing to reflect upon a story you may tell about yourself, a story perhaps you grew up hearing about yourself, or perhaps a story you might tell about another, a child, a partner, an ex-partner, a co-worker, a boss, a parent. To pick one. Again, if it's a story you tell yourself about yourself, or a story you tell about another. And just to take a moment to kind of listen to the story, to press play, as it were, on that narrative about yourself or another. And to pick one, not to feel like you have to shop around to get just the right story, but just to pick one. And notice as you let this story play of yourself or another, what feelings, how the body responds, if there's a delight or a joy or a constriction, a tightness. He's like this, da da da. If it has that kind of tone, or if it's a sense of delight, oh, this person. I'm always like, again, listening to the tone, to the pitch, to the cadence, to the speed of the words, of the narrative. Listen to the tone, to the pitch, to the cadence of the words, under the narrative. What are we really saying about ourselves in the story? What are we really saying about another in the story? Is the story we're telling about ourselves or another in alignment with those values? What we hold dear, how we want to show up. In the telling of the story, are you aware of a sense that this story of yourself or another leads you to a place of ease and calm, or if it agitates and stresses the system. In that noticing, ease, stress, there's a choice there. Do I want to keep telling the story about myself, about another? Does this serve me truly? I might feel more righteous, more powerful, more energized. But is it in accordance with the values, with the constellation, with the signposts of how I actually and truly want to show up in this life, this precious life? Who and how would I be without that story of myself, of another? What might it feel like to occupy that place where there is no story? It's just this breath, this beating heart, this in-breath, this out-breath, this sound, this smell, this taste, this touch, this thought. That's really the blue sky, the expansive ocean. How does it feel in the body to put down that story? To rest in the bones of the body, in the muscles, in the tissue. To rest and trust in the goodness of your heart, in the steadiness of the mind. To simply rest in this moment, this breath in, this breath out. What would it be like to live and love and learn from this place? What might the world be like if more and more and more of us could live and learn in love from this place, free from the conditioned habitual mind that imprisons us and locks us down, and can live from that place of expansion, of blue sky and vast ocean view. So thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.